You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 338.
On today's show, we talk about the origin of written language on Rapa Nui, figurines in an Etruscan well, and a Danish town that finds a medieval convent under a soccer field.
Let's dig a little deeper into that goal. Soccer goal. No.
Goal!
let's dig a little deeper. Goal! Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
All right. So our longtime listeners might know that we bought a house back in March and stopped full-time RVing. But we're still doing RV trips.
Yeah, we like meant it to be part-time. We wanted to not have to be on the road all the time if we didn't want to be.
Yeah, so we screwed up and grabbed my nieces, who are 5 and 7, almost 6 and 8 this month, and took them on a week-long trip to Dollywood.
We did. We took them to Pigeon Forge, and it was, you know, it was an experience for two people in their 40s. Mm-hmm. Ish.
40s? Who I'm not in my 40s.
Who don't have kids and have never spent a whole week like as the only like adult figure in a kid's life. Wow, it was sure an experience for us.
I'll tell you what, I have a newfound appreciation for those families that RV with their children.
I know.
I mean, a lot of them do it in a fifth wheel where mm-hmm. a lot of times there's an extra room and there can be extra, like an extra room. It's called a bunkhouse class A. We don't have one of those. We just have a couch that turns into a queen bed. So it's mm-hmm. nice to have that space. But even then, like we're putting them to bed at 8:30, 9 o'clock and we're in the back. The wall is paper thin.
I know. Like we were like watching TV with our headphones in so that we wouldn't wake them up. Although like legitimately they sleep so deeply, they probably wouldn't have heard the TV, but
you don't want to risk waking the beast.
You don't want to wake the beast. So that it was certainly an experience. But Pigeon Forge and Dollywood and Gatlinburg mm-hmm. and the Great Smoky Mountains National Park is such a fun area. And we have traveled in that area before, just us, and enjoyed it. And we've done it with my family and enjoyed it. And doing it with the two of them was great, too. It's just, it's touristy. You're going to roll into Dollywood and see all those big, stupid Ripley's, believe it or not, tourist attractions. And there's a gigantic like Titanic ship that you can go and like have dinner and a show at, I think. Right. Isn't that how that one works?
I think it's part museum too, though.
It might be part replica. Museum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like there's a lot of silliness around it, but like if you just lean in and have fun, it's a really cool place.
But it's right at the doorstep of the Smoky Mountains National Park as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
And we took the girls. It was their first time really going to a national park.
Yeah.
And we got them their Junior Ranger sticker and stamp. And,
yeah, that was cute.
They're suburban kids, so it was also the first time we went on a hike, and they got to like walk into a waterfall, basically, and hike in a creek. And the one girl who's the youngest, who's completely feral, just like after she took her shoes off once, never put them on again.
Yeah, she just like did the whole, it was only a mile hike, but she did the whole thing barefoot so that she could just hop into the creek anytime she wanted and play on the rocks. It was cute. It was fun.
So.
Yeah.
You know, some other place we need to visit.
Where would that be? Can we cruise there?
Easter Island. And yes, I think you can.
Maybe. I don't know about
that. No, I think I've seen itineraries where they stop. Really? They're like the repositioning cruises where they're crossing or the bigger, longer ones, you mm-hmm. know. But I've heard of Easter Island being a cruise stop for some of these boats.
Okay, sure.
I don't know how the people of Easter Island feel about that. But either way.
Yeah. Well, they've had a lot of experience welcoming, you know, European people people of European descent to their island. So,
I mean, a lot of people know about Easter Island too, which is kind of crazy. It's such a small little place, but I feel like a lot of people know about it and it is quite popular, especially among mechanics.
Oh, why didn't I see that coming? You get me good sometimes. Oh my God. Stupid popular mechanic. I didn't even notice that's where this article came from.
Yes. Well, yes. Remember when it was popular.
Idaho Statesman that was all of our articles?
What happened?
I don't know what happened to them, but I liked when it was Idaho Statesman.
Come on, Idaho Statesman. Step it up a bit.
Seriously. Oh God. Anyway.
Okay. All right. So something cool has happened at Easter Island. And in the time scale of archaeology, it's probably been taking several years for this to actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, one of the things that we've always kind of wanted to know was how old was their writing that they had there? It's called Rungo Rungo. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Actually, if you go to the article, Popular Mechanics did a nice little video that kind of summarizes the article as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So watch that. But anyway, it's called Rungo Rungo. And was it independently invented on the island, which would be a rare circumstance? Not too many societies around the world have developed writing.
Well, it's not exactly rare. Like, it happened in Egypt. It happened in China. It happened in lots of places. But it was more developed societies that did that, which I think is what would make this really special.
But bigger, more developed societies is what's rare.
There's
millions and millions of small cultures that have existed, even with their own languages, that are just a valley away from the other language, right? But they didn't develop writing.
Yeah, the writing is definitely. So. And the other interesting thing is this is undeciphered script. So if we could decipher it, maybe we could get a few more clues here, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And I guess the population that lives there now has lost this language too, because... So,
has anybody thrown this into AI and AI translates it as the year was 1342?
Oh God, please. Can we just leave AI out of it? I've seen so many bad AI stories lately.
Oh my God.
Like, did you see the one about the a school agenda for a middle school in Kentucky?
I don't think so.
Like, put a whole bunch of AI pages at the back of the notebook. And it's got Schmuntucky is how they spelled Kentucky, and Norgia is Georgia. Oh my God, it's terrible.
AI doesn't spell so well. I don't know what the deal is with that.
And the periodic table was made up of jumbled letters and words. So anyway, AI.
I mean, for a lot of people, the periodic table is a bunch of jumbled letters and words.
I mean, for middle schoolers, it probably is. But let's at least give him the real thing to start him on the right track.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, random tangent. I just read that story and I was like, is this serious? Anyway.
So first described by outsiders, the language Rungo Rungo was described in 1864, but Europeans first arrived in 1722. So there's always been a little bit of speculation that when they first saw and described this script, was it developed after 1722? Or was there earlier European involvement? I mean, that's the first Europeans as we have dictated by history.
Yeah, it's kind of why wouldn't the Europeans have mentioned that they had a written language earlier than 1864, if it existed.
Easter Islanders, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, if it existed earlier. I think that's been kind of a question. But it could just be we don't have that evidence either. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, we might soon.
Yeah.
There are 27 known inscribed objects. And on this study, researchers used radiocarbon dating on 4 of the inscribed tablets. Yeah, just 4 of them.
I wish it was a bigger sample size, but yeah.
I mean, this says there's 27 known inscribed objects. I don't know if they're all wood. So there's that. Yeah, that wasn't in the
article. Because other things would be very difficult to date. But yeah.
So one of the tablets, out of the 4, only one of them dated to prior to European arrival, which was 1493 to 1509. That's what the wood radiocarbon dated to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, one of the problems with radiocarbon dating is this isn't necessarily when the wood was inscribed.
Right.
The wood was... This is when the tree was cut down.
It's when the tree was cut down.
It's when the tree stopped growing, basically, and died.
Yeah.
So
that's always the caveat with dating wooden objects is it's when the tree died, not when the person chose to use the wood.
Yeah. So the other argument with this is, so that's when the tree died.
Yeah.
But was it inscribed at that time? Did they cut down the tree and then use a piece of that wood at the time to write this script down on it?
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then yes, predates European contact. But one of the arguments is, well, what if it was just a piece of wood that was lying around?
That they just picked up and used.
That they picked up post 1722 and inscribed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the researchers is like, yeah, we can't discount that, but a 150, 200 year old piece of wood wouldn't probably have been the best thing to write on at that time.
Be pretty dry.
I would almost disagree with that a little bit, because if the piece of wood is around, now, and we know it's at least, we know it's 500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times driftwood, when it's just battering up against the coast, and they would have had a lot of driftwood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I lived in an area, I grew up in Washington State. I grew up jumping around driftwood, and I know some of this wasn't 500 years old, but some of it might have been.
Yeah, it could have been.
And sometimes that wood just gets really worn through time, and it's not like a rotten piece of wood in a forest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
that is an interesting point, the driftwood piece. I wonder if they could somehow test for that to see if it was waterlogged by salt water or something to determine if it had been driftwood at some point in its life. But maybe not, though, because it's an island, so everything would be kind of salty.
Well, yeah, but I feel like something that lived its life in water might have a different signature, but who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, because like I hear that point that you might want a fresher piece of wood to carve into, that you're going to take the time and put all the effort that it probably would have taken to inscribe this language. You'd probably want a fresher piece of wood to do that.
That's also modern bias, where that's an easy thing to do.
Exactly. That's modern bias. And what if there just happened to be this really lovely piece of driftwood that floated up, or even just a really nice piece of wood that got dried out in a field and it was like the perfect size piece, whatever. And they used that instead. I mean, you know, you just can't discount that. So
the other problem here, like you mentioned earlier, was sample size. Only one of these tablets falls under pre-contact by radiocarbon dating. The other pieces of wood are post-European arrival. Mm-hmm. So at least by radiocarbon dating.
Yeah. But what's more likely? You know, like if you kind of step back and take in the big picture, like, is it more likely that these people, they developed the writing before Europeans got there, or that in the 100 or so years between when Europeans got there and when they described this writing, that they developed it? That's a pretty short amount of time to develop a written language, right?
Well, I feel like, and it wasn't discussed in this article, probably the original paper, I would imagine, but I feel like the evidence of European involvement is not very strong, aside from some of the time associations, because you look at the language that's inscribed on that one piece of wood, take a look at the article, there's a picture of it. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like any European language that exists today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's symbolic.
So different.
Yeah. It's more like hieroglyphics almost.
Yeah. Right?
So
like the only influence from Europe that you could, from Europeans that you could get there, is just the fact that Europeans were writing language at that point, and these Islanders weren't. So like they got the idea to write it down in some way from meeting Europeans. But other than that, the influence doesn't really seem to be there from European language, right?
I mean, yeah, there's the other thing too. Maybe it's not a language at all. Maybe it's just, I don't know, symbols.
No, they're pretty sure it's a language, right? They call, I mean, Rongo Rongo, it's like.
Yeah, it's, I understand. But if it was only 300 years ago and people were writing on these tablets, I mean, I understand that a lot of people of Eastern Ireland were decimated basically by disease and just, you know, their own infighting and the collapse of Easter Island, the famous collapse, that whole thing.
Yeah.
But there are still people that live there. And I don't know off the top of my head if any of them are descendants of the original inhabitants of the island. I think there was. I don't think everybody died.
And then
people moved back.
Yeah, there's some descendants. But it did get down to like 20 people or something at one point. So.
But if it was only a couple hundred years ago or 300 years ago that some of these tablets were getting written on, I mean, how is there nobody around that has any idea what that means?
Don't they say that like, this is language, not writing, but don't they say that like a language dies out like every few minutes on this planet?
Cause once a week, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. So, okay. That's every few minutes.
Every few minutes is
whatever,
a lot.
Same thing. No, but like the point still stands. Like once the last person is gone and they're gone, that information dies with them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah.
So, well, anyway, one of the reasons this is important, and there's the sort of inflammatory nature of the article headline, which pulled me in, of course, because the article headline, I don't think we've mentioned it, was a new discovery at Easter Island could rewrite history we know it.
Always rewriting.
I mean, sure.
Are they making a play on words, though?
Because
this is written language.
Yeah. I mean, rewrite history at Easter Island, but not necessarily anywhere else. Although what they're trying to say is, as we mentioned already, these systems of writing are usually only invented by
complex societies,
which Easter Island wasn't what we would typically define as an overly complex society. Yes, they had chiefs. Yes, they had, you know, that sort of
they
society.
They were structured. But they were building the
heads.
Moai heads. So like they definitely had a pretty strong structure, but writing is a later development typically.
Yeah.
Now they didn't. This island didn't even get populated until like the 1200s, I believe. So they hadn't even had that much time.
Yeah, but they came from somewhere.
Well, they came from somewhere and they brought, you know, their culture with them. But as in developing a culture on this island, they only had a few hundred years before the Europeans arrived. So it's all very quick, very fast moving, fast paced development on this island. Interesting and different from the rest of the world, which is interesting.
One of the downsides of archaeology and archaeologists is that people tend to specialize in something, in one thing, in one area, in one tiny little thing, because there's so many things you really kind of have to niche down in order to, well, you know, get your tenure and do your publishing and all that other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I would be interested to see you know, where the theories are right now, because I don't have this on the top of my head, where the Easter Islanders actually came from when they populated Easter Island, if we have that information or what some of those assumptions are.
Yeah, and I don't think we know that, but yeah. No,
but then also, are there any symbolic written languages, even rock art or something like that, that could be similar to what they're finding on this wood? Because if one of these does date back to the late 1400s and, you know, they moved to they first inhabited the island a couple hundred years before that, it's not a long time, you know?
Yeah, so true.
Maybe they took something with them.
They might have, yeah.
Who knows? Maybe it evolved. Sure. But
well, it seems like the first thing that needs to happen is they need to date more tablets or more objects with this writing on them.
Yeah,
because if they get more early dates, then that definitely strengthens the argument that this writing system was developed pre-contact. And that would be super cool. So
yeah. And the other hard thing about this whole deal is apparently a lot of the objects that have inscriptions on them are not even on Easter Island anymore.
Yeah.
They've been collected by various people, possibly sent to museums. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who knows where they're at? Well, I think they do know where they're at, but they say that they're hard to access, which tells me that a lot of them aren't held by museums, more than likely.
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot of private collections and also museums, British Museum, that are unwilling to give up certain things.
Yeah.
So isn't there a Moai head? We saw one.
We saw one. It was a smaller one.
In the British Museum, right? Because they just, you know, it was small. It was the biggest one that could fit on their ship. And
yeah, probably.
Off they went with it. So,
Anyway, so yeah, interesting to see what's going to go on with this, if they can manage to date anything else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have any other cut wood examples that would help us with that. It's really just the inscriptions that we need to figure out, you know, what's going on there. So,
and I'm sure there's work going on to decipher these, but with only 27 pieces, it's going to be challenging, you know? So
yeah,
we just need that dang time machine. Where is it? Wind it up, head back in time, and let's see what was really going on. Put it on my list of places to check out.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to go from Easter Island and then learn how well the Etruscans found their water. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 338 of the Archaeology Show. And now we're going to talk about Etruscans.
Yes. Yeah. So this article was published in Live Science and it is called Archaeologists Discover Etruscan Well That Was Ritually Opened with Offerings for a Goddess and quote unquote closed with human bodies.
Yeah.
Bit of a reach in that title, but we'll get to why in a second here.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is archaeologists in Italy have discovered bronze statuettes, a unique bronze plate, and also human remains at the bottom of an ancient Etruscan well.
Yeah. Now, let's just throw in a little bit of a note here. We worked on a site in Miami that we've talked about before on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a well there.
Yep.
That was dug. And there were bodies. Human remains at the bottom of this well.
Tons of bodies.
Dating back thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, different people had used it. The Spanish had used it when they got there. And why you would throw bodies in a well, I don't really know. I mean, this says it's ritualistic, but is it just like a thing? Like bodies are thrown in wells? I mean, you want to hide something, I guess, but
yeah,
there's also a ritual.
There's the hiding aspect. There's the ritual aspect. There's the like just this. We need to put these somewhere and we can't dig a hole because we're too close to the water. So the water, you know, that's just not a good place to dig a grave. But we have this well we're not using anymore. So
I can't imagine that would make the water taste all that good, though.
Well, I mean, that's why I say not using anymore, probably. But anyway, this one is a well that was found near modern day Bologna at the site of the Etruscan city of Kainoa. And I needed a little reminder of the Etruscans because they're like Greek adjacent, right?
Mm.
And they established the city of Kainoa in the early 5th century BCE.
So yeah,
that's where they are.
Yeah, the well was located near a sanctuary dedicated to Uni, who was an important Etruscan mother goddess comparable to the Roman Juno.
Mm.
Yeah, Uni was associated with women, marriage, birth, fertility, and growth, which I think a lot of cultures who had multiple gods associated like female goddesses and gods with water and fertility and things
like
that.
It's like life-giving that kind of thing. So that's why the researchers believe that this well had some kind of ritual or a ceremonial function rather than just being a place to get water, essentially.
Right. Yeah, the well and its artifacts date roughly to the late 6th or early 5th century BCE, so long, long time ago.
And the idea is that the artifacts that they found at the bottom, these little statuettes, and there's really great pictures in the article, so go take a look if you can. This is an Apple News article, and we're going to try to find links to other articles too so that you can see it if you don't have Apple News. But the little statuettes that they've found at the bottom of the well, they're statues of like women or girls. So the kind of thing that might represent you or somebody who's important to you, or maybe even a goddess or whatever. And that's why they're thinking these are symbolic, because you would then toss that into the well during whatever ceremony that you're doing for whatever purpose that you're doing it for.
Yeah.
Could be the symbolic birth of Kainua, the city, possibly too. Yeah.
Yeah. The fragmented remains of these statues are two bronze females, and they depict elaborately dressed girls or women, possibly representing elite women or goddesses.
And similar figurines have been associated with Etruscan water cults, which is not something I had ever heard of. A water cult.
Sure, why not?
Awesome. But this is the first time that these figurines have been discovered inside of a well.
Yeah. Young women are known to have dedicated similar statuettes to Uni, suggesting they were votive offerings. So just not in a well situation.
Right.
At least not that we've found so far.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were broken too, these statuettes. Yeah. So it seems like they were probably deliberately broken, and that would again possibly be part of a ritual ceremony, whatever they were doing with this well at this location.
Yeah, they also found a bronze plate, which is relatively unusual because bronze was pretty precious to the Etruscans. They didn't have a lot of it. They didn't use it all the time. So having a plate out of bronze like this was pretty special.
Yeah. And then to toss it down a well too, like that sort of begs the question, was it some kind of offering? Was it accidental? Cause like, listen, you set a plate on the side of a well, like it's entirely possible it gets knocked in by accident too.
Yeah.
You can't discount human accident when you're trying to assign importance to things, because stuff does happen by accident.
I know somebody carried these little bronze statuettes over on the plate and they're like, ah, crap.
And they like
just knocked it off
like,
the edge.
Trip and fall and like everything breaks and falls in. Like, I mean, it seems unlikely, but like you have to keep that in the back of your mind as a possibility also.
Because this is a common Etruscan plate style. It's just in bronze.
Yeah.
They've got lots of examples of them in ceramic plates, but hardly any, if none, in bronze.
Yeah. And like you said, bronze is super valuable. And we know that it was pretty important to the Etruscans because they viewed this transformation of copper and tin into bronze as like a kind of like a living thing. Like it was a regenerative process. It was kind of alive or whatever. So it was more than just making a material. It was, it was symbolic.
And that goes along with the whole idea of this well. They may have connected bronze with birth and regeneration, which are the central aspects of Uni's religious domain. So the goddess.
Yeah. So it totally makes sense that they would make items out of that material to then dedicate to her in some way.
Yeah.
The objects themselves are super cool. Again, go look at the pictures because they retain a lot of their like original bronze color or luster. And that's because they've been underwater in an oxygen poor environment. So you don't get the normal corrosion that turns things kind of like green, right? That you normally see on bronze. That's really neat.
Yeah. Water itself, as we've kind of alluded to already with this water cult thing, held strong religious significance for the Etruscans, which is why the construction of a well, which is a necessary thing. You have to have wells. You have to be able to get water. You can't always just go to a stream or something and get water. So, and they knew that, but the construction of a well was often accompanied by rituals because of its significance.
Yeah, that is interesting. So like maybe it's less of a like I was thinking of it as like a pilgrimage place where you like go there and like throw in figurines to this goddess. But maybe it was less of that and more just like they built a new well. And part of that process was like a dedication to the goddess. And they had to throw these in the first time when it was first open, and then they could just use it after that.
Possibly. It is relatively close to the Uni's sanctuary within this little city. So they say maybe those unusual deposits suggest it was part of a sacred area or ceremonial area.
Which would go back to the other idea. Yeah. Who knows? So. But then you would think there would be more of those figurines. But I guess they're still excavating, so maybe they will find more.
I mean, if it's just like a dedication sort of thing, you know, then why continuously throw things in, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I don't know.
The emphasis on fertility was probably especially important because Kainua was located in the Apennine Mountains, and agricultural productivity is just super important for that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and archaeologists also discovered the skeletons of one man and one woman inside the well. So when we're looking at the article headline, this is where it says it was closed with bodies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where this idea of the bronze objects were associated with opening it. And then the human remains might have marked the closing of it.
And I can only imagine that's true because you wouldn't throw humans' bodies into a well you're drinking out of.
No, for sure not.
You wouldn't know that 1,500 years ago.
Yeah. But you would think that these would be like sacrificial victims, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence that these were human sacrifices on the bodies. So, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what kind of knowledge of plants and things like that they had, but they could have poisoned them and that wouldn't present itself on the skeletal remains.
It's true, but poison is typically like a sneaky, underhanded thing. Like when you're sacrificing, you want it to be like, it's like loud and proud, right? Like the world knows that this is a sacrifice.
Maybe, but I'm thinking if this was a ritual well, and I guess, again, we're not Etruscan experts, but
no.
I'm thinking if this is in a ritualistic place, they might not want to fill it with blood. You know what I mean? So having somebody die by poison, and there's, these people are smart, right? There could be relatively benign ways to die by poison. Like it doesn't have to be vomiting and, you know, spewing out your mouth. It could just be you lie down to sleep and don't wake up again.
Well, they don't know how they died.
No.
So they do plan further investigation, including DNA analysis, to determine who they were when they died, maybe how they died, if the bones can somehow give an indication of that. But yeah, like there's plenty of ways to die that wouldn't show anything in the bones. So we just might not ever get that information.
Yeah, that analysis may also help reconstruct the chronological history of the well, including when it was opened and ultimately when it was abandoned. Mm-hmm. If we can kind of nail that down a little further with radiocarbon dating.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So
anyway, this is pretty significant because these artifacts, the statuettes, the human remains also being in there, and then the whole water cult idea, there's a lot of symbolism there. And then bronze, too. The fact that they use bronze for the statuettes. Like, all of that is, like, it all comes together into this really nice picture of what we already know about Etruscan cults around the goddess Uni and this sort of female-centered religious stuff. So, like, it does seem that something of that nature was going on here. We just need to do more research to find out exactly what. And I'm thinking they need to do more excavation in the well and see if they can turn up more figurines and things too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super cool though.
All right. With that, we're going to head over to Denmark with, I would say, more female religious significance by means of a convent. Mm-hmm. So there you go. And it's a CRM project. So a commercial archaeology project. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 338 of the Archaeology Show. And this next article is called Danish Town Plans for Underground Parking Garage Finds Long Lost Medieval Convent. Why can't we find any medieval convents in our parking garage constructions?
We
find lots of fun stuff.
Have medieval so much.
Yeah, well, we have the time period. We just call it medieval.
Yeah, it's not the same at all.
Yeah, we do find plenty of stuff, though, I guess, from that time period.
But we do.
Anyway, this is in Denmark in a town I'm going to horribly mispronounce called Roskilde. West of Copenhagen.
Right.
I mean, but Danish has a lot of like consonants and vowels and weird ways to say them. So
we should have checked in with Steph about it.
I know, right? Yeah, we have a friend who is Danish.
Yeah.
Anyway, they planned an underground parking garage beneath a local soccer field.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of like, man, an underground parking garage under a soccer field. And they were going to put the soccer field back on it once they were done.
Yes.
So
yeah,
that's
that was
crazy.
The plan.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, it makes sense. You got to go up or you got to go down when you don't have a lot of space. And if the soccer field is there, then you're going down. So,
So a required pre-construction subsurface survey revealed the likely remains of a long lost medieval convent beneath the field, which is really cool because this is literally a CRM project.
Yeah.
Totally. Cultural resource management.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they had a pretty good reason for looking because they knew that this convent was somewhere in the area. And they're like, we just got to make sure that we're not going to like be hitting something like that. And then, right. of course, sure enough, they which do is, this work and here it is.
Which is totally crazy. In the first article, we're talking about Easter Island going, hey, does anybody remember this language from, you know, 500, 600 years ago?
Yeah.
Possibly. But here they're like, oh, yeah, we know this conduit was here in 1256.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it's here somewhere.
Right.
You know, it's just the difference in record keeping and mm-hmm. historical documentation and things like that. And it's just, it's crazy that we even knew that something could be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they used, I think you mentioned ground penetrating radar to mm-hmm. confirm the traces of this. And as a reminder, ground penetrating radar basically looks like, almost looks like a, I don't know, kind of like a lawnmower almost yeah. without wheels.
I always think of it as like the paint machine that paints lines. On yeah. the field, they, yeah. it kind of looks like that.
Kind of like
you,
that.
Yeah, like you roll it across and right. it's got the lines. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them these days do have like four wheels around them in a cart, but they yeah. sit super low to the ground.
Yeah.
If they're up too high, it could give false readings. But yeah. apparently, I mean, I read in the article, the indications here, like a lot of times you have to interpret the signals you get back from ground penetrating radar, but they're like, oh, that's a convent. Like, there's the walls, there's yeah. a thing, there's well, a that.
And this is another one where you really have to go look at the article and see the picture, because they've outlined on an aerial image of the soccer field what they found with GPR, and it's like pretty obviously like it's yeah. some kind of like church related type of thing.
Yeah,
it's pretty clear to me. But like I said, they knew that this convent was in the area mm-hmm. and it's called St. Clair's Convent. And sure enough, like that's what this is. You know, it's pretty obvious. The complex dates to around 1256 CE. And historians had assumed that nothing survived, which is why like nobody's really put a lot of effort into finding yeah. it. Right.
And I guess the fact that they didn't think anything survived, this does put a little bit of a gap of knowledge in the monastic architecture from that time period
in this area,
for sure. But this was a major religious and royal hub in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So it's probably why we have such good documentation about it.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened to it? So it was a convent for a couple hundred years, but during the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, many Catholic institutions were dissolved, and St. Clair's is one of those. Not only was it dissolved, but it was demolished. Like
they put up a soccer field.
Right. Like they literally took it apart brick by brick, and a half a million of those bricks from the convent were reportedly reused in projects at the nearby Celso Castle. Mm-hmm. So because they know that these bricks were reused in a different structure, again, more reason why nobody was really looking for this thing, because they were like, it was freaking deconstructed. There is nothing to find.
Which tells you the power of ground penetrating radar and non-destructive excavation methods, because I'm sure some rocks, maybe some foundation
probably
still
foundation,
existed,
yeah.
but it was enough to really see the outlines of these walls and stuff, even mm-hmm. though most of it was dismantled,
yeah.
which is just super impressive. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not quite to Star Trek levels of, oh yeah, there's a whole substructure under there, Captain. Right. You know, we don't quite have that yet, but man, is it getting close with some of the tech that we have to look underneath there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're going to get to the point in some areas where unless you can surmise through maybe some dating, if you can pull out a sample or something like that, that it's something that's just completely unique and we need to really find out more information about it. I mean, the whole hope, I think, of a lot of archaeologists is that there's no more excavation, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, it remains, the best way to preserve something is to not dig it up.
Just leave it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. But I always wonder about that, because it's like one thing that I think is super important to archaeology and should be part of every site and every story that archaeologists are trying to tell is public outreach. And how do you tell people about a site if you don't have something for them to physically visit or mm-hmm. to show pictures of, you know,
like yeah.
it just becomes a blurb in a history book. And that doesn't have the same kind of impact as walking through the ancient footprint of mm-hmm. a convent would be, you know? So
yeah.
now I guess we have lots of excavated stuff on this planet already. So maybe we don't need to do more. There's plenty of excavated convents if you want to go see one, but.
And I feel like, man, I brought this up before, but like the old, I think it still exists, but Second Life.
Mm-hmm.
Second Life was pretty huge. I mean, for the last 20 years, Second Life has been around for a really long. I remember when I was in college in the early 2000s, and that's when people, I feel like, were really starting to get into it. And people built replicas of big famous archaeological sites, but built up in a way that you could actually walk around these ancient ruins, but as they would have been, or as we think they would have been in antiquity, right? Now, this is, when I say walk around, this is using your arrow keys on a keyboard and, and not so great graphics, right? But with the advent of virtual reality and more people being able to afford things like an Oculus or something like that, you can get an Oculus, which is a great device, for $399.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous how cheap they are these days. The barrier to entry is way down. And some of those programs that they have in there, people are doing the same thing. And I don't think we need to actually dig this stuff up if we can get a good idea of what it looks like. Because we know this convent from the historical data. They took all the stones out. This literally is foundation.
It's just foundation. Yeah.
What are we going to get by excavating it? A few artifacts? That would be cool. But if we're looking at the architecture, which they specifically mentioned, I feel like that could be probably recreated without excavating.
Yeah, totally true.
And you could literally walk around it. We could pipe in the sounds, eventually maybe even the smells.
Yeah.
And, you know, the time period and live it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
So. I think what you miss by not doing excavation is like the day-to-day life that people are living in a place. You don't get to know what they're eating, artifacts, what they're drinking. Yeah, that material culture is not adding to the picture of what the site was. But you don't necessarily need it either. So I also think
better subsurface detection methods will fix that.
It could answer those questions too. You think so?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while before we can do that. But or at least before we can do it affordably. Because
that would be cool if you could get to like an artifact level and you could see like, oh, those are pig bones or like whatever. That would be really cool.
Honestly, I think the intersection of AI and technology is what's probably going to do that. Because one of the big problems with determining what's under the ground in almost a microscopic level is the ground is full of things that aren't artifacts.
Like how do you identify what you're looking at with any amount of certainty?
You need a computer to take a look at it and parse out what doesn't look natural made, you know, what looks man-made, and teach a computer what that means and then do it. And you'd have to do a bunch of off-axis stuff too. You can't just shoot straight down, you know, you need to be able to, like LIDAR does. LIDAR gets all kinds of angles.
Yeah. But yeah, for sure.
Anyway, they said the results here are unusually clear, possibly among the clearest GPR monastery images in Scandinavia.
And yeah. I mean, they're amazing looking in the pictures.
Yeah. They're like the structures were almost visible in real time. Without data processing.
Very cool. And the mapping that they got from the GPR suggests that you've got cloisters, you've got room divisions, there's what definitely looks like a church, and then a well-preserved eastern wing with more walls and vaulting pillars. So you know, they have a really good like floor plan with lots of different spaces just from this GPR. So
And they didn't just do the soccer field either. They saw that this thing was probably heading off, or maybe the footprint of the parking garage is bigger than the soccer field. One of those two things happened, because first off, if you look at the picture, you can see it's obviously offset from the soccer field. It wouldn't match up exactly. But then they can also see external buildings and structures that probably would have been in support of the main monastery.
So Roskilde's other four medieval monasteries are mapped and legally protected, right? But this soccer field wasn't, and that was because they just kind of assumed there was nothing there to preserve or map or even know about. So it's kind of in this like in-between place where they've got to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah, the archaeologists are planning some preliminary excavations to verify and assess preservation. So usually they'll probably take some of the, maybe not the best spots on the GPR, because they may preserve those. If this is going to be an underground parking garage, though, they're going to dig all of it up regardless, because that's going to go deep. Or they might say, sorry, no parking garage, we need to keep all this.
I have a feeling it'll be that one, because like they'd have to blow through all of this to put the parking garage in.
Yeah, but if they've got like three or four other decent ones and this doesn't provide any like brand new information. I mean, yeah, we think, hey, this is super cool. It's an 800-year-old monastery. Why wouldn't we preserve this? But we don't have 800-year-old monasteries here in this country. They've got lots of them in Europe.
That's true. Right?
So if it's not providing new data, they may just blow through it after they collect what they can. They'll excavate down, I think.
I would hope that they would excavate the majority of it and try to add as much as they can to the picture. Because Like, what if there's a graveyard associated with this?
I don't know.
Somewhere that, you know, like,
the unfortunate thing is you look at this and you look at the size of the, you know, how big a soccer field is. It's mm-hmm. not small. I mean, this is millions of dollars in excavation.
Oh my God, it's so much.
And then decades yeah. of preservation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just,
it's a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to plan, you have to factor that in, unfortunately, when mm-hmm. you're talking about commercial archaeology.
It is. It's like, it's the unfortunate downside is like, sometimes it's cost prohibitive and then you get stuck in this place where it's like, what do you do? Nobody mm-hmm. wants to destroy it, but also you got to get your project done, and finding that compromise, I think, is really one of the hardest things about, you know, cultural.
Yeah. I personally think what's going to happen is if it seems like with preliminary excavations that this is important, and they need to assess, they're going to go forward with preservation, and that means excavation.
Mm-hmm.
Then the parking garage is definitely out. Those yeah. people are going to move on. Investors are going
to
pull out.
They'll find somewhere else, to put it. Yeah, yeah.
And then I think an excavation is probably going to drag on for years.
Do they lose their soccer field too?
Oh, the soccer field's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Because like the soccer field is kind of protecting it right now. It's kind of nice.
Sure.
Like if you don't put a parking garage there and just leave the soccer field in place, like that's really nice preservation for yeah. this site, you know? So
and they could do preliminary excavations on the soccer field and mm-hmm. beyond, and then fill those
and
holes
back in. And
then
just refill it in.
Yeah, and continue yeah. using it as such until, mm-hmm. you know, university steps in or somebody steps in and says, okay, well, this is an annual field school now. Start digging.
Yeah. So I do. I kind of think that the ideal solution would be to just do the excavation they need to do, but then let it go on as a soccer field and just keep preserving it, because yeah. that would be great. But
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're not going to preserve this episode any longer. So
it's past its expiration date for show.
100%. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And again, thanks to those of you that continue to write in and give us comments on the episodes. Our email addresses are on the show notes for each episode, so feel free to do that. We may not respond to everything. I try to, but yeah, continue to do that either way.
I'm notoriously like bad about checking my email or replying to anybody. So.
Including mine, by the way. Not just fan emails, but like she doesn't respond to my emails or text messages.
I am right. I live with you. You can just use words to talk to me too.
No. I literally used the speaker in our living room to send her a message earlier today.
Yeah,
and
that
I could have
super annoying.
I could have said my words out loud and she would have heard them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. You're a very annoying person.
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right.
All right, with that, we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.